Hosting for this podcast is made possible through mtgcast.com, which is supported by a generous contribution from quietspeculation.com, Magic's premier trading and financial news site.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Episode 3 of Everyday Eternal. I'm Sam Craven. I'm joined by Jacob Corey, Matt Pavlik, and Sean O'Brien. Today we'll be talking about the results of a couple different tournaments from this past weekend. We'll also be looking at, again, discussing how non-basics are prevalent in the format and what you can do to attack and exploit that. And then for some listener feedback, we're going to go over for just a moment or two how the new sideboard rule affects Legacy in general. So let's get right into it. Sean, do you want to tell us about the New York Stacks Exchange results?
Yeah, so a few things. One, this was a $100 entry fee, proxy vintage in Long Island, New York, and they got 78 players for a $100 tournament, which was pretty impressive. I thought I might get a chance to go. Plans ended up getting in the way. And as far as I could see from the coverage, the event went off really well. And there were some interesting top eight results. Most notably, there were no dredge decks, and the only workshop deck was actually a Genesis Chamber Skull Clamp deck. So to call it a workshop deck, it certainly wasn't one of the traditional pillars. But there was some nice diversity in the top eight and some nice diversity in the field. Another thing of note was there were two blue decks that featured no less than three Restoration Angels in the top eight, which is definitely new ground for vintage. I think I don't think Restoration Angels made a made a real appearance in any kind of major vintage tournament. So some interesting stuff. The event was won by Paul Mastriano, who piloted Suicide Jay's Fault. For those of you not familiar with that deck, it's a Dark Confidant Jace deck, full force of will, three Jaces, and usually tries to tinker out Blightsteel or Vault Key.
Pretty unusual choice for three spells in your main.
Yeah, so he made a definitive choice to combat Sphere Effects, maybe Oath with Spellsnare, and I think
possibly Standstill as well.
Yeah, exactly, and perhaps quite a bit of land still. So, and you can also see in the two blue-white decks, the decks that feature Restoration Angel, they're basically the old Bomberman list, but you've gotten rid of the awkward Salvager, who, you know, is about as good in combat as Poland, and replaced it with Restoration Angel, which is great against Jays. No offense to the Polish army, if there's any listeners in Poland. But, and yeah, everybody running Spell Snare all over the place. It's a wonder that the Burning Oath deck, the one Burning Oath deck that did make it, made it. So a pretty interesting field. The actual breakdown of the field included a pretty good balance. So you have a field of 78, you have 9 running Dredge, you have 6 running Dark Rituals in some way, shape, or form. About 16 assorted Null Rod type decks, Stony Silence decks, and then the
18
rest
workshops.
Yeah, 18 workshops. So, and even amongst the workshop decks, you see you know, a reasonable amount of diversity, culminating in a completely, not completely new look, because this deck's actually been around for a while, but certainly a new cut on workshops, which is just pure aggro, just trying to mer and permanent you out. Using Genesis Chamber. So a pretty interesting event. I'm sad I couldn't make it because it looked like it was a blast.
Yeah, definitely excited to test against some of these decks, maybe even play against them this weekend in Vegas.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see if anybody tries to go this route. I know these decks were probably geared towards the Northeast metagame. You can see a lot of anti-workshop hate main, so you know that might not work at Las Vegas, but sort of the principle behind Restoration Angel being an anti-Jace creature, a creature that's useless against Jace, plus being this super value creature in a deck with Click, Trinket Mage, and sometimes even Snapcaster Mage, is pretty sweet. So,
what about Star City results? We had Columbus at the Origin Game Fair.
Most notable to me was there was a lands deck that came in third, which is a deck that we don't hear about all that often. It pops up every few months and just takes a top eight or a top four, so that's pretty cool.
But I'm pretty sure Bobby has been playing this deck the last few Star Cities as well. His name seems super familiar.
Yeah, he's done a lot of stuff. I don't know, let's click on him.
I played him at Legacy Champs probably 3 years ago, and he was playing lands. So he sticks to his guns.
Yeah, I think this situation is a matter of, like, this person knows his deck really well, so it didn't matter what was going to happen, he was still going to do really well with this deck. But it just so happens that Lens is really well positioned right now because it's just a better control deck than a lot of stuff out there. Same as I noticed Jeff Hoogland, who's been playing four-color Loam, or just Loam in general for the last little while, top 8, top whatever, 16 again. He's playing a deck that he obviously knows how to play really well, and it just so happens that it's really good against the meta.
Four Chalice of the Void tends to be pretty good.
They both run Punishing Fire, which compared to the lands deck that Bobby brought to Legacy Champs, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, he didn't have a utility burn spell like that available to him. But having Mana Denial and having Punishing Fire kind of jumps on what we talked about last week when it comes to crushing some of the greedier mana bases and the decks that rely on Death Threat Shaman heavily to power out their spells and planeswalkers.
I think for this tournament, we definitely see a theme of lands and land hate. For instance, in the Bug Walkers list by Michael Kletz, he runs Intuition and Life from the Loam Engine to essentially recycle his Wastelands and Factories, essentially putting a lot of pressure on fair deck mana bases.
The number two deck is also a Mana Denial deck. It's running four Stifles, four Wastelands, and aggressive clocks like Delver and Geist of St. Traff. So, I could see that deck getting off to a fast start, stifling a fetch, lightning bolting a Deathrite Shaman, yeah, and just pounding his opponent down with a Geist.
Also, too, if you notice the Grim Lavamancer there, we were talking about Grim Lavamancer last week as a possible utility tool against all these, like, X1s that that the Esperblade decks are playing. And look here, Grim Lavamancer.
And you'll notice a common thread. We've been talking about Mana Denial. That's something we'll be talking about later today. It's something we feel is really strong in the meta right now, and we'll be getting into that a bit later. In first place was, yet again, Todd Anderson, piloting Esper Deathblade. Going against what we had suggested in our last podcast, he actually made his mana worse with a couple Abrupt Decay main board. Anyone have any thoughts on this, or do we think we pretty much covered this last week?
No, it gets even worse. There's a Caracas in the mana base, and it's up to 3 Wastelands now.
Yeah, it's odd that while he ruined his mana base, some of the games that we watched, it looks like the Caracas played a huge role in those games, both to keep legendary creatures out for his opponent, as well as provide the necessary white mana at the most opportune times for him.
Well, you are truly a pro's pro if you can draw that one Caracas when you need it.
It certainly takes a lot of luck to win tournaments, so Todd Anderson proves that again, as well as being a good player.
Personally, I disagree with the move towards Abrupt Decay. I'm not sure, like, maybe there's a niche of removal that he needed, but I notice also, too, they've shifted away from Snapcaster Mages. So what this kind of means is, I mean, instead of having the plan of, say, 4 swords, 4 Snapcaster Mage like they were having before, you had this really awesome removal suite to kind of handle any creature deck. Again, you're getting to a situation where I've removed my Snapcaster Mages because everybody's running Deathrite Shaman, so that means my Snapcaster is a liability, so I'm going to add more real removal, hence the Abrupt Decay and the Detention Sphere. Now, the question is this a good move or not? Well, I think this basically means that any fair deck, like, again, like we were talking about, like, say, Maverick or Jund or whatever, who's playing more creatures than them, is just going to run them the fuck over.
Yeah, it lowers the blue count also, so he still has 3 forces, but you know, if you look at the blue count in this deck, it's pretty. There's a paucity of blue cards in here. To support it.
He's got 14 blue cards.
I think it's skirting the line for how many blue cards you would need. It would also explain why he would go choose a card like Detention Sphere, which
it does have the awesome keyword.
It does have the awesome keyword, being blue and castable with islands. In some of the games that I've watched him play from the coverage, the Game 1 Detention Sphere actually played a huge pivotal role for Todd Anderson to make his comeback from X1 earlier in the day. So I think in one instance it took out 3 Noble Hierarchs to set his opponent back to 2 mana, and in another instance took 2 Deathrite Shamans to, again, set his opponent back to 2 mana. So again, we see where essentially controlling the amount of mana opponent you allow your opponent to play with really sets the tempo for the game.
Well, while we're on that, do we want to go ahead and transition into that discussion?
Wasteland. My favorite
Wasteland. That card is awesome.
It's not blue, and you can't cast it using islands, so we'll just have to call it a great, great land.
It costs 0. That's even better than costing blue. So, in short, our feeling is, and we discussed this a little bit last week, that the mana bases in general in Legacy are very, very greedy right now. There's a lot of non-basics running around. You can see in these Esper lists, a lot of them are running at most 3 basics, some of them 2. In Todd Anderson's case this week, he's running 0 non-basic lands. That's a lot of Wasteland targets. In addition, there's a lot of non-land mana. Most of that comes in the form of creatures that cost 1, which means they can be swords, they can be lightning bolted, they can be abrupt decayed, and
or disfigured.
Or disfigured if you're running disfigure, and and that means that if you can attack a mana base, you're going to be in a really good position for the rest of the game, because obviously casting cards is really important in Magic: The Gathering.
Maybe we can talk about some of the different ways to play Wasteland. Obviously, putting 4 in a deck and calling it good is probably worthy enough to make top 8 in most local tournaments. But specifically, different strategies that Wasteland can be employed. For instance, you can use it as a tempo element, essentially to buy a turn. You see this a lot being used in a Maverick or a Goblin deck, where all you really want to do is essentially buy a turn for your aggro plan to close the game out.
Yeah, the original plan with Wasteland all the way back in Tempest was any deck whose curve essentially stopped at 2 or 1, you know, would then essentially Wasteland its opponent out, you know, having no need to make another land drop, you know, with Sly being kind of the first deck, or the old, you know, Jackal Pup was the classic strategy. So the original tempo strategy with Wasteland is my deck has 1s and 2s, so I'm going to play my 1 out, and then I'm going to waste you out from here on out, sacrificing my own land drop, which doesn't matter because all I'm doing is playing Delvers and Nimble Mongoose and other 1 casting cost stuff. So Wasteland is a tempo strategy. It's also a utility strategy, being able to nug utility lands. And then I think, you know, against some of these
I think
decks,
you would be able to, Sean, you of all people would probably be able to describe Wasteland as a prison strategy.
Yeah, the final piece then would be just Wasteland as a lockout strategy, either to lock them out from 1 color or to lock them out of the game entirely. So it can be a tempo play, it can be a utility play to push a creature through or nug a special land, or 3, it can just be a strategy on which a whole deck is built where you want to just lock somebody out of a color, or combine it with Crucible or Life from the Loam, and then perhaps even a Sphere effect to just lock an opponent out of the game.
Going back to the rug or tempo threshold strategy, a lot of times you see it paired up with Stifle or taxing counters, or even taxing creatures like Thalia. And I think Maverick used that strategy where Temple Thresh used like Stifle and Wasteland and Spell Pierce to keep the opponent operating at a very early game, essentially. One of the highlights there is using a low curve to and small weenie creatures to be able to push that through.
there was a Death and Taxes list. I think it placed 13th. And that deck's another deck that, you know, kind of rides the middle ground. It's Mana Denial with Wasteland, Port. And then it also has some spear effects like Thalia. And, you know, their Jackal Pup is essentially Aether Vial. So once they play their Vial out, they're more than willing to sacrifice their land drop to Wasteland their opponent's mana because they're planning on playing the majority of their 25 to 30 creatures out via Vial. So, you know, that's a deck that, if it was played more, you know, I think you would see it have a real favorable matchup against these super greedy mana bases. I'm not sure the deck is that popular, so.
And aside from Wasteland, you're also running four Rashidun Port, at least in this particular list. You're going to be running some number of Flicker Wisps, which can hit a land just for a turn if you need it to. And you're running Mangara, which can take a land permanently, and that's a lot of Mana Denial right there.
Yeah, it's a strong deck. It's a strong deck that can attack from a lot of angles, but I think it's a deck that has a lot of subtleties. A couple of people at my local store play it or have played it on and off for the last year, and you can tell that, there's a massive difference between the folks who just picked that deck up off the internet and the folks who have played that deck for a while. And there's a lot of synergies. All the cards are synergistic with each other. There's a very specific order you want to play the creatures in. It has a lot of ways to interact on the stack, even though it's not a blue deck. You mentioned Flicker Wisp. You know, I could write a tome on the number of tricks you can pull with Flicker Wisp in conjunction with an Aether Vial. So Death and Taxes, I think, would be a powerful deck now against these greedy mana bases, but I just think it's not popular for a number of reasons. Learning curve, it's just a non-brainstorm deck. There's probably it's got a lot of things going against it, so.
Four Caracases is pretty rough for most people's collection, too.
Yeah, that's true. It wasn't a couple of years ago, but now it sure is. Yeah, even Port's $50, so.
On the topic of unpopular non-blue decks, Blood Moon is actually a really, really good answer to a metagame such as the Star City Open. If you just look at the top 16 decks, I think there may be only one deck that might be able to get out of it, and that's the Death and Taxes deck, oddly enough, just because they have basics and Aether Vial.
The Omnitail deck, maybe. They got 10 islands.
And a lot of fetch lands, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Omnitail caves to another card that's commonly played in Blood Moon decks, and that's Trinisphere. So, you know, a Blood Moon deck, you know, packed with Trinispheres and Chalices, could certainly make a splash if the whole metagame looked like this top 16. You know, those decks have the same flakiness associated with any stompy style deck. They tend to mulligan a lot. They tend to mulligan poorly. So, but Blood Moon could be a powerful strategy right now.
There was actually a deck I built for one of my friends. He's getting into Legacy and asked me to build him a deck. So, you know, I hopped onto the source and looked at the new in development form. Which is probably a bad idea in disguise.
It's fun.
But, it's a fun adventure, for sure. But I ended up actually finding a strategy close to my heart. I'm a mono-red kind of mage. And I stumbled across the mono-red sneak attack deck, also known as Big Red. And this deck's pretty interesting. It's essentially a show-and-tell kind of deck, but without the stigma of being a show-and-tell deck. So it runs very similar shell. It has 8 enablers. It's got 4 Through the Breach and 4 Sneak Attack. For acceleration, it runs Seething Song and Spirit Guides, as well as the fast mana double lands. And for disruption, instead of Force of Will and cantripping, which obviously a big hit when you're not playing blue, it chooses to play 4 Blood Moon, to kind of disrupt mana bases as well.
You're
as,
saying there's no stigma attached with it, and then you're playing 4 Blood Moon.
Well, just because your friends will hate you, though.
I think we discussed in episode 2 that the more fun you'll have by removing the fun factor for your opponent.
I agree.
I mean, is that any less or more fun than getting, you know, Cunning Wished out of a game with Release the Ants? I mean, honestly, I'd rather be Blood Mooned and watch somebody beat the crap out of me with a World Spine Worm than watching somebody wish for Release the Ant.
Yeah, and the best part about World Spine Worm is that every opponent asks, wait, it has trample too?
Yep.
And
it's that good, kids.
He's the green Grizzlebrand.
Nah, I wouldn't go that far. It's probably the green Emrakul.
Is there anything else we have on the mana denial front?
Yeah, I would just like to talk about how Esper Deathblade is using its wastelands, because we've noticed that the number of wastelands in this deck has gone basically from 0 or 1 at some point, now up to 3. So people may be wondering, like, you've got this awful mana base, and yet they're playing their own wastelands, even though you're so color-intensive. So maybe just want to talk about how they're using their wastelands versus, say, like, the second-place deck.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a... I personally don't... I mean, over a 9-round tournament, I couldn't see any of these mana bases working without an exorbitant amount of fortune. But, and I know Brainstorm glues a lot of this together, Deathrite glues a lot of this together, but, you know, that deck can still make the play of turn 1 Deathrite Shaman. Turn 2, let's say their opponent just ponders off of a non-basic, they might just wasteland and go into Stoneforge, you know what I mean? It's not a terrible play if you think your opponent's mana tight, but
I think there's a lot of depth to when to play and when to activate wastelands in a lot of these varied strategy decks, especially in a deck like Deathrite Blade, where you're able to use the wasteland to essentially activate your Deathrite Shaman to produce mana, and it actually has the net positive of producing 2 turns worth of mana by activating it. So I wouldn't be surprised to see Deathrite Shaman and Wasteland being paired up in greater frequency over the next coming weeks. Especially because it's just such backbreaking to an opponent who has a weak draw or maybe a slow draw. Setting them back a turn more likely will allow you to get to your later curve. For instance, like Jace or Liliana, or I mean, even Jund can play Bloodbraid Elf and accrue massive advantage. I would actually like to see Jund come back to the forefront in this type of metagame. It has the aggressive feel to it. It has access to Punishing Fire, which is very good against the quasi-mirrors that we see with Deathrite Shaman and Dark Confidant, as well as access to a full 4 Wasteland in those decks.
I mean, that deck seems really well positioned. I mean, between Abrupt Decay, Lightning Bolt, Punishing Fires, Liliana, like, I'm pretty sure you're controlling this creature matchup. And I feel like an interesting sideboard card right now. This is gonna sound weird, but Goblin Sharpshooter. Hold on.
Yes, that does sound weird.
However,
I'm curious how you got to that conclusion, Matt.
Well, everybody's running a lot of like Dark Confidant and Snapcaster Mage, and Vanillion Cleek. Like, a lot of X1s, and also, too, I mean, to combat the Jund decks, if the Jund decks kind of come back a little bit, Lingering Souls becomes better. So, I mean, if you're running into a lot of decks with Lingering Souls again, or at some point in the future, Sharpshooter gunning down all those little guys, not necessarily a bad thing.
Or Dark Blast, I think, is the other card that probably could give a run right now. You know,
sure.
Jund doesn't mind filling up its graveyard, and Dark Blast, you know, Dark Blast hits, as you mentioned, a bunch of the most wanted guys right now. And then the other, you know, you can play tricks with Sylvan Library. There are things to do with dredge cards. So, but Jund, you know, Jund is one of those decks. I think it gets a stereotype as being a derp caster guy turn it sideways deck. So again, I think we probably have some. You know, some appeal.
It certainly feels like that when you play against it. I don't know, I haven't played it, but that's what it feels like when I play against it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it doesn't have a lot of lines of play other than rape your hand, play my big man, punch you in the face. So that may not appeal to a lot of players who want to feel like they have a little bit more control over the top of their library. You know, maybe some Jund deck that comes back with 2 or 3 Sylvan Libraries or something.
Which I never understood. A lot of the Jund decks were running 0 Sylvan Library or 1. The card is really, really good, folks. Like, I don't know why you're not running, you know, 2 to 3. I mean, I know if I'm playing against a Jund deck and they suddenly drop a Sylvan Library against me, guess what gets Abrupt Decayed? Like, 100% every day. Sylvan Library must die.
Alright, let me paint this scenario then. Suppose you have an opponent who goes turn 3 using Death Ray Shaman, of course, cast Bob and Dark Confidant and Sylvan Library. If you had only one Abrupt Decay, what would be your target?
Sylvan.
I agree, Sylvan Library. Sylvan is going to let them at least get a little bit more choice over what they do, and Bob is going to at least keep hurting them.
Well, also, too, the Sylvan Library lets them set up the Dark Confidant as well the next turn. So if you... I mean, leaving them both alive means you're going to die very, very soon. However, I mean, depending on what I'm playing, Abrupt Decay going for the Sylvan Library so they can't actually dig. Because sometimes they're in a position where you can just go 8 life, dig deep, now I've got 3 extra cards. Like, I mean, a lot of the time when I'm playing junk against, say, Miracles or something, if I land Sylvan Library, the first thing I'm doing is just digging and drawing my 3 cards. And a lot of times that's usually game over for, like, the slow control deck that just can't deal with Sylvan Library. So if I had to Abrupt Decay one thing, it would at least be the, Sylvan Library.
It also has pretty good synergy with Liliana. You know, you can get up a couple cards and then the discard effect isn't so painful on you.
Or even on the flip side, being able to stack your deck, or at least the top few draws, take an irrelevant card and then activate Liliana so you're keeping the good stuff on top.
Yeah.
Also lets you set up your cascade. You get to dig a little deeper and say, you know, this time I would rather have a Visions of than I would or an Ancestral Vision than I would a Termagoyf. So let me put the Termagoyf on underneath my Ancestral Vision so I can draw a bunch of cards.
Sylvan Library, hell of a card.
Yeah, it's got a lot of words on it.
If you're not playing it yet, and you're playing green, look into it. If you're Esper Deathblade, stay the fuck away from it. It's ours.
You can't have our library, our green.
Esper Deathblade needs more green. It needs to be Dark Bant Blade.
So also, too, if they Notion Thief in response to your Sylvan Library, folks, choose not to activate Sylvan Library.
It is a trigger.
And they don't draw, they won't get to draw the cards, because you just draw normally. So don't fall for the trap of activating it.
Ah, Notion Thief.
We've yet to see more Notion Thief in the format. And it makes me sad that there's still only one in the sideboard. For the same argument that we can make for Sylvan Librarian showing up as 2 or 3 of in green midrange decks, we should be seeing the same argument for blue decks running Notion Thief.
Well, I think the Notion Thief is not quite popular enough yet because of the fact that there is only one Jace on the field at a time. So
I agree.
So are you foreshadowing that come July we might see a resurgence of Notion Thief?
I am saying that, yes.
Does anybody here know what Foreshadow actually does, the card? Don't
cheat. I have an internet connection.
Don't cheat.
No, I don't know.
I want to say it's a Tempest Block card.
Yeah, it is. It's a little earlier than that. It's Visions. It's a slow trip predict. Yeah. Anyway, moving on. You can get it in Korean. Look it up, Jacob. You'd love it.
Oh, okay. I'm going to buy up the internet from it.
Probably just to wrap up our topic on attacking crappy mana bases in Legacy, what decks could you play to jump on it? The other deck that I would cite would be Metalworker or Mud. I think it's got the mana denial element of Wasteland. Plus, it has the backbreaker of Chalice and Trinisphere. But unlike some of the other color-based stompy Chalice decks, everything's colorless, and you have the hammer that is Lodestone Golem, and the deck finishes like no other with, you know, your pick of robots, Steel Hellkite, Forge Master, or just Golem.
Or if you wanted to, Sundering Titan.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, that seems like the quintessential one-sided Armageddon.
Yeah, you may get four against Esper Deathblade with Sundering Titan. That would be an exciting...
Four against Jund. There's a guy in our local meta who's been playing it recently, and he's been pretty much, if he gets to 2 or 3 lands, he pretty much blows out everyone. And it's the attacking the mana base while not caring about your own, because you're doing things like, oh, I'm going to play a Wasteland every turn, it doesn't matter, because I have a Metalworker out.
Yeah.
Or you're playing artifact mana of some kind, like Mox Opal, or if you had Grim Monolith, or whatever.
Or you're really clever and playing... Shivan Reef to not become affected while still keep casting your colored spells.
Well, you have you have two builds of that, not to dive too much into Metalworker, but I think they fall into two camps. You know, one is the one that wants four keys and is trying to get either a Grim Monolith to double tap, or in some cases, Thran Dynamo, I guess our best case for Metalworker. And then the other one that just wants to stick a chalice on one and move on from there. And so another great tool for that deck, too, is Cavern of Souls. I played Metalworker at the store a few times with Cavern, often naming Construct, and that's a wicked addition to that deck, being able to ignore the force on your Metalworker.
So I think in summation, if you want to be playing the decks you probably want to be playing, if you're trying to beat like all the Esper Deathblight / awful mana bases or anything with Blood Moon, Recurring Wasteland, Punishing Fires decks like the 43 land, or any sort of like Loam long game deck or like Enchantress, anything that basically has a good solid mana base or just shits on small creatures, I think that's basically where you want to be.
Let's not forget Seismic Assault.
Oh, God. Well, I didn't want to delve too hard into Seismic Assault because I'm going to talk about it for a while now, but the card's so good.
We'll save it for another topic. I'm sure Jeff Hoogland will continue his top 16 finishes, especially since Star City seems to be focusing on the interior East Coast at this point.
Like, I mean, sorry, I got to talk about this at least for a second. Give me a minute.
Go for it.
I mean, the deck, I mean, I'm looking at his list now. He's running 4 Mox Diamond, and he's running no Deathrite Shaman, which I know he's running the Chalice of the Voids, but I feel like with a Loam deck right now, like Devastating Dreams, ridiculously powerful. Punishing Fires, Abrupt Decay, Sylvan Library, like I've been playing the same kind of base for a long time, and it like this is a really good place to start. Chalice of the Void, totally shutting down all their cantrips, their removal on your guys. Legit. I think I would actually be playing Terravor as well.
I love that card.
Terravor sounds a little bit derpy, and I know people are like, oh, well, what about Knight of the Reliquary? Terravor has Trample. That's a big deal. A lot of people don't think about it, but it's a big deal. Not much to say, like, running over them and getting through, like, killing all of their guys, and then possibly, like, say, their Jace or something. That's really relevant. What else could you be running in here? You could run Deathrite Shaman as well.
Actually, recently this weekend, I actually played against a player, long-time aggro loan player, and he was running the full 4 Deathrite Shaman and Punishing Fire, Abrupt Decay. He ran Liliana's. He crushed my soul when I was playing Elves. He went turn 1, Deathrite Shaman. Turn 2, Liliana, sack your guy. Turn 3, Seismic Assault, get Loam active. I'm sitting there thinking, I don't think I can come back from this, like, in the match. Like, this one game just completely set me back.
Yep. Like, Seismic... Like, he's not even running Seismic Assault. I didn't even notice that. I just assumed it was in the deck. Like, I just looked at this list and went, sure, he's obviously playing it. Apparently he's not. Seismic Assault is ridiculous. I mean, sure, they're going to get your Loams if they're running Deathrite Shamans or whatever. But, I mean, you have Life from the Loams, you have Punishing Fires, you have so many cards that they have to target with their Deathrite Shaman. I mean... Once you get Seismic Assault online, you kill a few of their guys, like, that's it. They can't keep a Jace on board, they can't keep any guys on board, and every turn you're dealing them 6+ damage.
There was a guy at our local, he's probably listening to this podcast, actually, who brought, I think, almost card for card. He didn't have a 4th Dark Confidant, and he replaced it with what he called the Red Dark Confidant, Tybalt the Blood Fiend.
Oh, that's terrible. Ugh.
But anyway, he brought basically a card for card copy of that Loam deck, and despite punting more than Raul Alegre, he still managed to top 4 our Wednesday last week. The deck's just powerful, and I think Devastating Dreams is just the biggest blowout. Players don't plan for Armageddon effects anymore. Nobody sandbags lands, and part of the rationale for not running the Deathrite Shaman is probably just being so committed to that card, and just wanting your Giant Knight to be the only thing standing after, you know, after the Devastating Dream.
I think we touched the subject of how to fight greedy mana bases pretty well. Let me throw out a question here real quick to you guys. Suppose you were playing at Star City event this Sunday. What would you play? Sam?
Sam?
I think I would probably go with a Rug variant with 4 Stifle, 4 Wasteland.
I would likely still play Junk all the way, but I would tweak it. Right now I'm playing Lingering Souls, and I would probably throw some Loams in the board to help with all these decks that are running around with Wastelands. I'd also run Vampire Hexmage.
Interesting.
So, Vampire Hexmage, you probably know it from the Hexmage Depths decks from, like, 3 years ago, when everybody went nuts. Or your Tribal Vampire deck. Yeah, Sean. That's exactly where most people would know it from. But the card is really good right now because it's a 2-1 first strike, so against all the Esper decks that are running around with their little 2-1s, you're actually swinging in for 2. They don't have any good blockers for it. We talked about this, I think, last week or the week before. Plus, it stops them from playing a Jace. I mean, they can play a Jace, but you're immediately mucking their Jace. You have an onboard answer, a preemptive answer for Jace, which is something that a lot of the BGX decks have a problem with. If there's, say, like an empty board, or you're at parity, and suddenly blue deck drops Jace and suddenly just pulls ahead and wins the game. Having an answer, say, like Vampire Hexmage, as opposed to something like Maelstrom Pulse, which they have a turn to kind of, like, say, draw their cards and get a Force of Will, so you're like, oh, I have my Maelstrom Pulse here. Well, that might not be good enough. Whereas Hexmage gives them something to worry about that they have to remove first before they go for their Jace.
Yeah. And you know what? Most people don't know how First Strike works in combat.
That too. I mean, planning on other people screwing up is not something I like to do. However, if it works out, like, okay.
That's the only way I plan my plays. I ask myself, what's the best play here? Is my opponent going to mess up? If yes, here's my line of play. I don't even think about what the correct line of play is. Tends to work out more often than not in Star City events.
Where do I get the most bang for my buck? Okay. Let's assume he's going to screw it up. Go for it.
The idea of a bluff or a mind trick is not to be underestimated in a format like Legacy. And on that topic, I would actually take a big red deck, essentially mono red sneak attack, to a Star City event. It really is a quick deck. It has the potential for a possible turn 2 kill, which I actually saw my friend perform after I handed him the deck. Against me, no less, so I saw it firsthand. On turn 2, I got attacked for 30 with Emrakul and his best buddy, Wormspiring Worm. So the deck.
I'm sure that was fun for you.
And you didn't mention this. What was his record when he played this?
He played 2 local events, so there was a Saturday night Legacy, and he went 4-0 to get first place.
Jeez.
And then the next night, he brought it to a cash tournament, and he went 3-1-1 to draw into top 8, and then we split there just because it was cash payout. So, pretty explosive deck, if not a little bit inconsistent. His only loss in the second day was at my hands, so I feel like I got justice because he was playing with my deck.
There was a variant, one of the guys at the store is playing the big red deck, and he's splashing just a hair of white, and he's got silences and or is it Orm's Chance out of the board, which is pretty sweet.
Is he also playing Caracas to go combo with sneak attack?
He may. He posts on the source as well, and I think he's active in whatever big red thread exists there. I think he calls his like. Ginger Big Red or some variant of it. But yeah, splashing a little bit of white just to give you some game with silence and give you some better options out of the sideboard.
Yeah, that said, on the sideboard plan, I decided to throw in a 3-ball of 3-balls. And that actually became very instrumental against his victory over Omniscience.
Really? Turnosphere was good against the combo deck? What is this?
Yeah, who would have thought? turns out that's also how he crushed me when I was playing with Elves. A turn to Turnosphere against a deck with only one land in play is what we call Time Walk City.
Yeah.
Hey, but after July, you get to run your Gaea's Cradles one after the other and get through those Turnospheres, so don't worry.
Yeah, Turnosphere is a beating right now. I'm obviously a proponent of the card, but it's one of the better things when you have a little action in your hand to drop off of a show and tell. And particularly in the red section, you get things like boil. So show and tell taps out, you put a Trinisphere in play, they have to pass the turn, and then they are welcomed by boil.
I would love to see a pair of boils in the top 16 of this tournament.
How many people know boil is an instant? How great is that?
Yeah. I would cast it sorcery speed, just like Brainstorm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you run it out, you play your fourth land for the turn, right? Just, because you assume...
And just jam out boil. Like, don't even think twice. Land, boil, go.
100%. That's the correct play.
You did mention the legend rule, and I think there was one topic that we missed during our initial podcast discussing the rules change.
Nice segue, Corey.
Nice.
That's what I'm here for.
Pro level.
Keeping on the schedule, the change to sideboard rules, which I think we discussed briefly but never actually got into a discussion about, effectively, your sideboard can be up to 15 cards when you register your deck, which means to 99.9% of people, it's going to be 15 cards and a 60-card main deck. But there is the possibility of running a 61-card deck list, for instance, a deck that runs a lot of Tutors or Green Sun Zenith or even Knight of a Reliquary. For instance, I've many times ran a 61-card deck list where Maze of If was a 61st card. Now I have the option of running a 14-card sideboard and trimming down the deck for unneeded slots against, let's say, maybe combo, where I need to really have that efficiency going.
Yeah, I think where you're going to really see it is control deck, boards against control deck, where going up to 62 cards or whatever just doesn't matter because it's going to be a 7-8 turn game. And you're going to see so many cards. And decks with tutors, too. I think you're going to see, sort of bigger main deck.
Yeah, I think for a deck like, say, Miracles, where you're running, if you're running the Enlightened Tutor plan, you know, bring in the extra Blood Moon or something like that, or the extra Humility, just to have, because you know that you're going to be able to tutor it up, is totally fine. I mean, we can't deny that the math changes when you tweak from, 60 to 61 to 62. That's undeniable. However, does it matter enough for the matchup that you're in? Maybe or maybe not, right?
I agree that when you have a tutor package, that's when I think it'll be most relevant, because I know I play Thopter Sword countertop, and one of the hardest decisions every time I sideboard is, well, which one of these Enlightened Tutor targets do I take out to put in another one? And I think you're right, that's one where we might just bring in an extra one or two cards and say, you know what, I'm not going to be trying to draw these anyway, I'm trying to Enlightened Tutor for them, so it doesn't matter where they are in my deck.
Now, my philosophy on 61 or 62 card deck lists almost always falls into the game plan of, I need just half a land more. If I could find a spell to cut to play an extra land, I would be happy. Unfortunately, I feel really, really positive and really confident about this, let's say, 46 cards non-lands, and I need that just little bit more land. That's the only time I feel that a 61st card is justifiable.
I mean,
that's fair.
For anyone familiar with statistics, the impact is actually pretty negligible. Like, for all the grief people get for running 61 card decks, it doesn't actually have a whole lot of impact. But a deck that has three or four tutor mechanisms, the negligible impact is washed away by the flexibility of having your one of warmth or whatever you want to stick in your deck. Because you really have four warmth, so.
I mean, it's the whole, like, buying a lottery ticket, your chances are one in however many million, but if you never buy a ticket, you're not entered in the draw, right? So, I mean, having Humility in the main, doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to see it, but at least if you do see the card to go get it, hey, you're in business.
Hey,
otherwise, you might just lose that game.
If you run a one of in your deck, you have about 11% chance of seeing it in your opening hand. That's going to matter against the Show and Tell deck when they drop down an Emrakul.
True. Kobe, you were saying before about the about Belcher.
Yeah, so we're kind of talking before the show about potential new strategies being developed as of this rule change. And one of these that came across to my mind, more so from the Vintage perspective, where you often see Leyline of Anticipation in quick combo decks, trying to essentially beat out Workshop. And Leyline of Anticipation allows you to do that. You just plop it down from your opening hand, and now your entire hand is instant speedable. One of the potential changes from going up to, let's say, 64 cards is being able to keep the same 60 stock list while having the added benefit of getting that ley line and comboing off on, let's say, turn zero before your opponent even gets to take his upkeep. The downside, of course, is now that you're adding four extra cards to your deck, you're less likely to see that ley line. But the potential still exists.
Exactly.
And for those of you who are unfamiliar with how to figure this all out yourself, your local community college certainly has math classes you can go to, which will teach you all about the hypergeometric distribution and how to calculate the.
And in my experience, the guy who teaches you will have an extremely thick Russian accent that you won't be able to understand.
At the Georgia Institute of Technology, it's almost exclusively a cabal of Chinese men, so, but your mileage may vary.
Alright, what was next on the list?
That's all we've got. Do we have any upcoming events?
Actually, we do. For the Greater Vancouver, Canada area, not Vancouver, Washington, mind you, we're having the Summer Legacy Classic. So, what that is every season we try to get together a bunch of people who play Legacy from all over the province, and hopefully we're trying to get some people from the States to come out and play Legacy. So this year it's August 17th at SFU Burnaby, and basically what it's going to be is going to be a $30 buy-in, and I'm just going to give out dual lands. So as many people as we get, I'm just going to give out more and more dual lands.
Will they come with a Ziploc bag?
I don't care how many people we get. I have the Ziploc bag of dual lands right here. So the point is, basically, I have a bunch of extra revised duels, and I want them to get out into the Magic community because I don't need them.
Well, Matt, I can go ahead and email you my mailing address, and you can just give those to me.
Well, I'd rather spread them out in the local Legacy community. So if you want more information about this tournament, if you're somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, like, say, NorCal or Oregon, and you're thinking about coming up, you'd like more information, you can email the podcast here, and I'll respond. So the email is everydayeternalcast@gmail.com. If this interests you, I'll definitely email you back the link to the Facebook page so you can find out a little more about it.
And we can put that in the show notes. There you go.
Oh, okay. That works too. You know, whatever.
I'd also like to make a quick reminder for anyone in the Southern California or Nevada, Arizona, NorCal vicinity, essentially the lower West Coast, because, you know, Matt is in the upper West Coast. about the MTG Deals open weekend, this is going to take place on July 6th and 7th, with some grinding events on July 5th. Got about a $9,000 cash purse between the 2 days, as well as a couple of power raffles on Saturday and Sunday. The Legacy tournament will actually be on Saturday, July 6th, with a Mox giveaway as a raffle. And a Black Lotus will be given out on Sunday for the Standard tournament. So if you're in the area or looking for some good competition, come check it out. It's going to also be the grand opening of MTG Deals' new tournament center. 12,000 square feet of nice, fresh rug to be played on.
Wow, that's pretty big. It's almost the size of Sean's house.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can afford in Atlanta.
Yeah, Atlanta's economically depressed, and since we're here in the South and are all debtor states, the real estate's really cheap. So,
hey, I thought we weren't going to be talking about speculation on this podcast.
No, that's fair.
Would you say that we're going to be quiet about speculation? I'm sorry.
Sean, is it good to have land?
Well, I actually don't really have land. I have a small backyard. I actually live in town in Atlanta. For those of you who have come to Atlanta for Magic events and gone up to Gwinnett, that's not Atlanta. That is like suburban Hades, otherwise known as the land of Gwinnetia. So I live in actual Atlanta. But anyway, but not downtown. you know, which is something out of a zombie apocalypse movie. So I live.
This is the second zombie reference in a row, by the way.
Hey, are we done with magic yet or not?
Yeah, I think we can close out the show at this point. So
who's going to see World War Z? Or who read the book knows that the movie has fuck squat to do with the book and is still going to go see the movie anyway?
I don't know. I might go see it. I haven't read the book, but I heard it was good. And then when I heard the movie is unrelated to the book, I'm not sure if I want to see it. But, I mean, it's got a giant budget. It must be at least entertaining.
Yeah.
Is it going to...
Hey, let's close out the show, and then we can just ramble on.
Okay. So, Corey, do you want to do it?
Sure.
Mr. Corey.
And that concludes the Eternal Podcast, Episode 3. Thank you, everyone, for joining. I'm Jacob Corey.
I'm Sam Craven.
And I just interrupted Sam.
And I'm Matt Pavlik.
Thanks for listening.
Adios.